Hello, everybody. Welcome again to the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today should be really fun. We have two self-described anarchists on the podcast, Glenn Ganaway, who's hosted before, and Daniel Berrien, who has been in the space for a long time and produces a lot of really quality content on YouTube, which we'll link to. So why don't we start, Glenn, why don't you introduce yourself? Some of our audience should be familiar with you already, but in particular in relationship to anarchist organizing and how it's influenced your life.
Oh, thanks. It's really good to be here, as they say. My view or my understanding and my position, the way I talk about anarchism is the description of the way things work. So anarchism, it means no leadership. There's not one person or one thing that is dictating everything. It's a collective. There's an answer that is already present. That's anarchism to me. It's means matching ends. It means integrity and all of those things. So I've been an anarchist as long as I've known how to make it, you know, found out what the description was, you know, read Bookchin and all the Kropotkin and, you know, all the people that you're supposed to read, you know, after high school in college. And because I wanted to make a difference, because I wanted I come from a religious background. So I wanted what I did and what I said to be creating what I wanted all the time. So, and you know, I found out that a good description of that is anarchism, which is why I really like Daniel's channel, Anarch, A-N-A-R-K, on YouTube, because it goes very much in detail about the practicalities of it and kind of rips the specialness or the scariness out of like calling yourself, you know, an anarchist or what, even from basic history to how anarchist thoughts and ideas can actually bring about the society and a world and experience that is beneficial for everyone, no matter what ideology or lifestyle or that your value. It's there for the expression of humanity. So that's how I come at it. And I think Daniel would come at it in a much similar way, but I'll let him describe himself and his journey to anarchism and what we're doing on a Doomer Optimist podcast. Daniel?
Yeah. Yeah, as they said, my name is Daniel. Sometimes you'll see me as Daniel Berrien or Anarch, A-N-A-R-K. So I've been organizing as a radical basically since Occupy. I learned about anarchism there. And I think, you know, I had a long journey to becoming more educated about what it entailed. But I think like a lot of anarchists, it kind of felt like it accorded to a feeling that I already had beforehand. And the more that I learned about it, the more that it sort of reinforced a lot of the feelings that I had. And in the process, I learned more about the implications of those things and what the how that folded out into an analysis of the world. And I think one of the big things to say, and this is generally what has to be said right off the bat when you're talking to people who are not super familiar with political theory, is that anarchism does not mean chaos. Anarchism does not mean no rules, anybody gets to do anything they want, nothing holds you back. Anarchism can better be understood as the opposition to hierarchical power structures, which I sometimes just kind of boil down to the opposition to hierarchy. It is the idea that relations of domination in society are bad, that we should try to create a society where there are no dominators. And as Glenn has noted, anarchism believes in a concept called means-ends unity. This is the idea that you cannot disentangle means and ends. If you set out to achieve some particular set of end goals, the means that you use have to be capable of producing those ends. And more than that, the means cannot be in direct contradiction to your ends. Otherwise, what you'll find is that you violate the principles that allow you to achieve those ends. You undermine your achievement of those ends. So for this reason, what you'll find is that anarchists support a horizontal method for achieving their ends, because their ends are a society that is free of domination and hierarchy, and therefore the methods they use must also try to be as free from domination and hierarchy as is conceivably possible. So I feel like we'll probably expand on this as we go, but I think, you know, that's kind of the starter for the topic. That's you know, what I would say to get us started.
Yeah, well, I think one thing I found really interesting about the second video that you had when you were exploring the science of complexity, and you were talking about, you know, this idea of orders of emergence and how, you know, from a kind of maybe a simplistic perspective, that would seem like it would be a hierarchy, right? Like the cells being part of the organs, being part of the bodies, being part of a social structure, being part of an ecosystem would seem like kind of orders of hierarchy. But what you were describing, and you can flesh this out, was that these are really patterns of interdependence between these different levels. And it's really hard to say that one, you know, is able to dominate the other levels in any meaningful sense. But that doesn't mean that there aren't these orders of organization or levels of organization, you know, and we can think of this, you know, in society as we have a hypo, you know, we have like a household, however that's composed, and then we have, you know, local systems, and then there's also, you can bring in this idea of confederalism, which is a, you know, an idea that you also talk about. And so do you want to talk about how, you know, with kind of horizontal structures, you still have these kind of orders of emergence that are interacting with each other, you know, I hesitate to say up and down the system, but at different scales.
Yeah. No, I think that is like a really good a segue into the broader topic. I think that one of the things that immediately confronts people when they are told about anarchism, that it has this bottom-up impulse, that it's very localistic, they get this idea in mind that means there can't be structures, there can't be layers of structure, because layers of structure suggest a hierarchy, pretty much precisely as you said. Mm-hmm. However, I think what we can see is there can be layers of structure without those forming what anarchists might call a hierarchy. So I suppose what I should note is that a hierarchy, insofar as it's referred to in anarchist you know, political theory, and a little bit broader than that, is where the layers have relations of domination going down, right? Yeah. So that is to say, the layer that is above the layer below dominates the layer below. It has the power to coerce and control the behavior of those that are in the layer below it.
Yeah.
But precisely as you were just getting at here, in nature, that's a pretty uncommon affair. Most of the time in nature, what you've got is relations going every which direction, mm-hmm. right? So it's like, if you were to try to understand a system of particles by just understanding the rules for a particle, you would have no idea how that system functioned in a broader sense. But as it begins agglomerating, you start getting a bunch of different laws that look a lot more familiar to us. It's when we agglomerate a bunch of particles together that, for example, we start to more clearly see macro scale objects interacting through Newton's laws, and the phenomenon of entropy begins to play out in a way that we're familiar with, and temperatures dropping as they're in sealed containers. All that stuff takes place through the combination of behaviors at the previous layer. And then it is a dynamic we notice determines the behavior of all of those layers beneath it. Right. So in a more holistic sense, what we really see taking place in nature, as you said, are these complex relations of interdependence, where there seem to be flows of energy, the way that energy is flows and is determined and moves around seems to be determined by dynamics at a bunch of different scales, and each of those scales form dynamics at other scales. So it's more horizontal in its nature, and furthermore, you know, as Bookchin says, a particle can't dominate another particle, right? That's a human conception. Mm-hmm. So relating this to anarchism as a political philosophy, what we're attempting to do then is create essentially a federated or confederated structure, which is to say you are nesting structures inside of structures inside of structures. But the big structures don't just get to determine everything, and they don't get to enforce the will upon everyone else.
Right.
Instead, the idea is it's more just that appropriate decisions about scale are made at each scale. And those who are affected by some decision are the ones who get to decide on that thing.
So this is the principle of subsidiarity. It's just one of the mappings that you made.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Subsidiarity is a term that, you know, if you go through like I'm a political science degree in college or something, they may introduce you to this term, subsidiarity. It's not one that you'll see presented in anarchist literature. That word, I don't think I have ever seen, but it refers to something that anarchists talk about a lot, which is that you should try to make it to where the most pertinent scale, the smallest, most pertinent scale, mm-hmm. is the scale that deals with any given problem.
Right.
Yes. And I think that's a really important component of this.
And I want to jump in and say that is actually, I think, the foundational bridge in which allows anarchism to, as a philosophy as a method, in order to reach wide consensus with very, very, very different people. You know, it's that bridge that Daniel's talking about how the nested inside of a nested inside of a nested, and always looking for the smallest way in the smallest, easiest, most practical, least energy usage, including mine, mm-hmm. makes it possible, because it all should be functioning according to the way that the world works, and not trying to impose again a box or a limit in which it doesn't, which only makes things gritty and stops the process. Because principled conservatives that I know have a very good critique at wanting small government. You know, the way they talk about it, everything like that is something other indeed. It's like what the small government is for. I would probably have a lot of issue with. But it's true, dealing with a problem at the scale in which it interacts with us as a community. Is a task for the community, mm-hmm. you know, which is what I think is why I wanted to really was interested in Daniel coming on to talk to us about prefiguration.
Yeah,
you know, can to be able get, to talk about before, how do we build that.
Before we get into prefiguration, can we talk about kind of the decision making processes, right? So we sure. hear about this term democracy, and you know, you have to ask, you know, what do you mean by that, right? You know, because there's at least in my mind, there's at least three ways that people mean that term. One is the representative democracy that we're used to, where we elect somebody to act on our behalf and we just kind of forget about it for a while, and they probably get captured by some corporate interest and they're actually not acting on our behalf. But that's the idea of representative democracy. There's the direct democracy where you see a lot in California, you vote on a proposition. And then there's deliberative democracy, which is, you know, forming kind of consensus-based decisions in an assembly or a group. And my understanding is that anarchism really operates by this third form of democracy, which you also call radical democracy. Do you want to describe that a little bit and kind of the mechanics of how that works, right? Like you're in a room together with the kind of the relevant people in the room whose decision that affects, you know, what are kind of like the protocols for how that takes place?
Well, I think this particular question is one which you'll find a bunch of different answers to. Yeah. I think that on the ground in the modern day, we use what is called consensus, which is where you have to get unanimity. Everybody has to agree to the decision. However, the big noteworthy thing on consensus is that, as you say, it is like deliberative, right? It's a process wherein we are offering things that we think need to be changed. We're offering amendments constantly. And then we are all deliberating through those amendments until we get a version of the proposal that we can all agree to. And I think another really important aspect, and this is more broad than just the modern day, is that in anarchism, proposals have to start from the bottom. The people have to be the ones to determine the proposals. It's not that, for example, there is some like there's like a group of representatives that develop the proposals and then everybody else votes on them. You know, that could be a form of a top-down direct democracy of sorts. It's instead that these proposals begin and live and are passed within those appropriate bodies, those you know, bodies of those who are affected decide, precisely as you say. Historically, you'll find that the topic is more complicated. There was a focus on this other concept more generally of what is called free agreement. And their idea is basically that it's agreement that is not coerced. They were very flexible about the form of how that agreement would look. Like would have been open to a lot of different forms of making decisions, but it was most important to them that in any of those occasions that it was not coerced, that the alternative was not some form of punishment or harm. Yes. And I think that insofar as with this word democracy, because I think you're precisely right to say that the word is like quite fuzzy and that you're going to find a bunch of people using it in a very different way. The word democracy, historically, anarchists, if you find anarchists talking about it in a historical sense before perhaps maybe the 1950s or 1960s, they would have been sort of like disapproving, because they would have been talking about representative democracy. So if anybody who's listening to this, you know, gets this idea in mind, they want to go start reading old anarchist theory, I'm just preparing you ahead of time that if you see them talking badly about democracy, they may not be talking about this sort of radical democracy or consensus we're discussing right now. They're really talking about representative or liberal democracy, wherein, you know, you elect somebody to do all the work and then they make all the decisions and you don't get to make any decisions afterwards. So I think it's important to emphasize that the two big principles for anarchists are free agreement, which is, say, absence of coercion not being part of this process of making agreements. And the second one being that it is a radical deliberative process where we are constantly offering amendments, and those amendments have to be heard out by the rest of the body that is making the decision. And then the person, based on whether that amendment passes or fails, gets to determine whether they will give their approval to the measure. I guess maybe one last thing that might be noted is that in this process, you kind of have a few different options if the person doesn't agree to the measure. All of you could say that's not good enough, we need everybody to agree, in which case you just table the measure or it fails. Or you could do something where you say, like, okay, well, everybody that does agree to the measure will act on it, and anybody who disagreed with the measure does not have to act on it. That's another way you could approach the problem. Mm-hmm. There's yet another way you could approach the problem, which is you all agree ahead of time, even if I don't agree to the measure, I will follow it, in which case you can express your disapproval, but you'll still abide by the measure in that occasion. I think what you'll notice is this is a very flexible model, right? We have lots of ways we could approach problems. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I would probably emphasize, is that that is the case historically, is that anarchists are trying to create these flexible decision-making systems.
Very neighborly. Very, yes. Very neighborly.
Based on a principle of solidarity. That word solidarity is extremely important to anarchists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we're all in this, like, what you do on your property next door to me with your cows or your trash or your car up on blocks or whatever like that does, you know, you're pouring gasoline into the ditch and stuff actually does affect, you know, my stuff. So, you know, it's the neighborly thing is you wouldn't think of doing that. You wouldn't want to do that to your neighbor because you know him and that you need him to come help you pull out of a ditch, you know, once a year when, you know, your son drives the car into the thing, you know. So you need, with this anarchism, I think, is really based on this eye to eye looking at you, where you are and where I am, and say, what are we doing together to, you know, make this all easier and hopefully fun? Right. Yeah. You know,
so as you know, as a person who definitely, you know, advocates for subsidiarity and minimum viable scale, you know, what if, but I assume that the harm principle is in effect. You're talking about externalities, you know, talk to an economist, they talk about externalities. You know, but if the scale of the externalities are national, bioregional, or global, how do you have that eye to eye agreement? I mean, you know, you can think of pollution in a river, you can think of anthropogenic climate change, you can think of rainforests in the Amazon that regulate the hydrologic cycle of the earth being cut down. It's kind of hard to have the eye to eye in that case. So how does, is this where the kind of the confederation, and how do these people, if it's not representative democracy, how do they, you know, how do you scale up if you see what I'm saying?
I absolutely do see what you're saying. And of course it is a struggle to find one completely conclusive answer that will solve all problems. I've offered a few different models, but one of the models that I think could be very successful is that even though so the measures start at the bottom, the proposal begins at the bottom. It perhaps is only in one little local council structure. And then they do a sort of fact-finding mission to ask, you know, who is going to be affected by the said decision? And you try to figure out what it looks like, that you know, minimum viable scales, I think you called it. You look at, like, you try to do, you try to figure out what the answer to that question is by taking into consideration what the affected regions and so on are. Then I think that what you could just do is take that proposal and tell all of the affected regions, hey, this proposal has been determined to affect your region. And then they just deliberate in all of their local councils that decision. And then they go through their local consensus process. They find out whether they agree or disagree with various portions of it. They make their own amendments. Then after you've done that, after you've got all of those involved councils to make their say yes or no, up or down, here are stipulations, you basically take a measure to see, did you reach consensus of all of the pertinent councils? Mm-hmm. And in that process, you don't have to get a representative to go argue it for you. Though it should be said, there is sometimes this thing called a spokes council, which mm-hmm. does get used in anarchism, both on the ground and in theory. Where let's say, you know, back in an older world when we didn't have like digital intermediaries, they'd say, okay, cool. Each of those councils make their decision. They've given their stipulations. They have determined these are their proposed amendments to the proposal and so on. And, you know, because once again, there wasn't as much technology, they would say, cool, now we're going to delegate some individual to go take those concepts and bring them to, you know, a spokes council of delegates for all the other councils. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't get to make new decisions. They would essentially be delegated to carry out the decisions that had already been arrived at by the councils. So they don't get to, you know, go, they don't get to make a decision that doesn't agree with what the council decided. The whole point of them is to go sort of as an emissary of the council's decision. Mm-hmm. And this is sometimes called the spokes council. I actually think that it's kind of outdated and unnecessary. I don't think you even need a spokes council. I think that maybe that was the case in like the 1700s or something, but we live in the modern era where technology, extreme digital forms could be used in order to mediate this democracy. So it seems to me like that's the answer to the question. Insofar as determining who is affected, once again, I think that is involved in that sort of like fact-finding mission. And I think it's quite possible that what might happen is that people might hear, say, some proposal that was said to involve these five particular councils. And some council a region over goes, that's not true. The thing they're discussing totally affects us. That you know, we're downriver from them. And if they make that decision, that's going. And then they could, I don't know, perhaps petition to be included in that process to for them to also be pertinent actors and their consensus to also bear upon the decision that's being made. Hopefully that was at least an okay answer to your question.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because there's a lot of talk in kind of what's generally called the Web3 world of, you know, how do we, you know, use the internet for these more kind of deliberative, kind of horizontal forms of organization. There's a platform we just interviewed some folks who are developing what's called the HILO platform, which they really focus on kind of bioregional kind of governance, but it's very much you know, and they're trying to include a lot of different kinds of digital tools that allow people to kind of vote, to kind of assign tasks to various people, to collaborate on various projects. And so it seems like just given the sheer complexity of our current civilization, you know, and we can talk about theories of change and how we want to see a change in a bit, but that's, you know, there's going to be a lot of complexity associated with that, right? Like, if I'm gonna, you know, emit some carbon into the atmosphere to transport myself somewhere, and if I have to get permission from every single council in the world, you're gonna need some pretty sophisticated tools to figure that out, right?
Yes, and the way I view things like that, things where there is sort of just some default assumption of who is affected by that given thing, and the number of people who are affected is enormous. It would probably take a long time to come to a decision, but damn, that decision would stand for quite a while, right? Like, that decision would be the standard for how things would be dealt with in a broader sense for probably a pretty extended period of time. And, you know, you might imagine that those big elements, those are going to be what determines who goes in the biggest scales of federation. You know, those sort of like basics of environmental rights, you might call them, or environmental, you know, regulations or rules, the standard treatment for all human beings, like what does life deserve? Those sorts of questions. Mm-hmm. Those are going to be decisions that bear upon everybody and everything. And therefore, they're going to have to be made at the largest scales. Those are not decisions that get to be made at the smallest scales. So there's, you know, this once this understanding is had, I think a lot of people's sort of naive concerns tend to clear up, because a lot of their concerns are like, wow, what if somebody does something really atrociously terrible at a small scale? And it's like, well, most of those atrociously terrible things shouldn't be allowed within their federation. And the federation could just defederate with them and could just decide like, oh, it's not cool to carry out a pogrom, you know, in your locality. That we stipulated that is not okay in this federation. That sort of thing affects everybody by its very nature. We already made decisions on that. So yeah.
So Glenn, you wanted to get into the prefiguration.
Well, see, and so if we can look at solutions to the world, talk about the world that we want to build together, and inside of what the knowledge that what is here is actually collapsing and going away. Now we can work on building what we want, or just like let it collapse and let somebody else, I don't know, determine the structure and the institutions that are going to be, that I'm going to be bound by. Or we could prefiguratively begin right now to create at scale, whatever scale, and I mean that at scale, me in my neighborhood, me in my floor on this building, the, you know, the neighborhood and so forth and so on, whatever the scale is, to begin now at creating the structures that will be able to withstand the rest of this collapsing, which we are watching this collapse is one reason why we're all sitting here on a podcast and called Doomer Optimism. So I want to talk to Daniel about some of this prefiguration. But my backup is, would you, I'm going to read you a quote, and I want you to tell us a little bit about how optimistic you are, Daniel.
All right.
Okay, but I'm going to read you. At the end of at the end of your video on constructing a revolution, you said this, and it really had an impact on me. Let us build a revolutionary ecosystem that will heal the planet and dismantle the justification of the overlords. And I think that's a really optimistic statement. And you made this beautiful video on hope that I listened to today, that the preacher in me was like, kudos.
Yeah.
So I'd like you to give us the optimism, part, and the hope that I know you share.
Yeah. So me and you talked a little bit before this interview just about the concept of like what is optimism and pessimism and so on, and I won't bear on too much at length there. You know, in my mind, I'm neither a pessimist nor an optimist, because both of these, what these mean is that I am predicting what I think the future will be. I'm not an optimist because I'm not telling you it's guaranteed we're going to win. It's I don't believe in guarantees. You know, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the future holds. I would consider myself a hopeful realist, which is to say, there are potential actions that could be done which could achieve our ideal future. And if we act in this way, which is, you know, consistent with that future, which abides by that means ends unity that we discussed, then that possible future that would help us to escape our misery, help us to escape this extreme danger that is pervasive now in the modern world, it is possible. And the only way that it will take place is by cultivating hope. That it's not only that we have to cultivate hope within ourselves, but that we have to cultivate hope in others. And because if there is no hope, nobody will act. Like, that's just, you know, if you think you're already screwed, then you give in to what psychologists call learned helplessness, mm-hmm. right? And when you have given into learned helplessness, well, that's it. You pretty much just stop acting. You just let it all happen to you. And so that's why I call myself a hopeful realist. It's quite possible that we could bring about a new society, that we could bring about the opposite of this exploitative, ecocidal system, but only under the stipulation that we act. And I think that's the part I always want to emphasize, only under the stipulation that we act. There is no inevitable future. There's nothing that's going to do it for us. The development of economics isn't going to do it. The technological progress by itself isn't going to do it. Humans are not just going to get their, you know, crap together on the fly and just, you know, figure it all out just because the world sucks. Once again, they could just give in to learned helplessness. The only way is if we act, and if we act in a way which is hopeful, that could actually produce a different society, and that we are always trying to bring out that hope that there is the possibility of a new society within others.
And I think that the point that we make around here at Doomer Optimism is the local is where that is really where that is most effective, the sharpest edge or point, or, you know, the leading edge, or whatever metaphor you want to use, is local. It's within arm's reach. The action that needs to be taken isn't, you know, oh, I wish somebody over there take this act, you know, I wish that there should be a law, right? You know, there's sort of the learned helplessness I was you've done a lot of you live in Tulsa, right?
Yes, I do.
So a lot of Doomer Optimists live in very like rural, semi-rural places. And there's a sort of a way of like, how do we transform these places that a lot of people moving out of the city into more rural settings? It's creating conflicts, you know, very old and ancient conflicts between rural and, you know, urban lives. And your Tulsa, Oklahoma is not known as a bastion mecca for anarchists. From my perspective, I live in New York City and trying to build a farmstead in Vermont. There's a lot more regular, and so you don't walk around and it's like, yah rah rah rah, I'm an anarchist. I mean, you don't talk about, but you do organize and take this action that you're talking about locally with.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot that I could say, you know, you did touch on a lot of issues there. You know, the first is, I think you're right that the split between the rural and the urban, and I would even maybe include the suburban in the modern era. I think that is something that is really coming into prominence, and True. We don't do a lot of reasoning about what that entails either. I think that those splits are very serious, precisely as you said. They're also very ancient, and they have made big differences in how we have to approach problems for a very long time, for not just hundreds, but thousands of years. And we're in a time now where that split is very stark in very, very serious ways. Those cultures have radical differences. Another thing I would say is that, you know, Oklahoma does have a lot of rural areas. Tulsa and Oklahoma City are very urban. You know, they're large urban metropolitan areas. That being said, the culture is super liberal and super radical in a general sense. Tulsa is probably the bluest that you get here in Oklahoma, which is to say that it actually has some history of, like, say, voting for Democrats or something, if that's a helpful metric for people around here. But it is at the moment actually still more red, more Republican in a general sense. You know, what I found is that people have all kinds of ideas here and everywhere. You know, like, it's always good to just start with the presumption that every individual is an individual and then let them tell you where they stand on the issues, right? Now, as far as me personally going around and do I present myself as an anarchist? Actually, yes. That is my personal approach.
I do too. That's also my personal approach. I build myself as your favorite anarchist preacher. That's just what I do. Yeah.
Yes. I find that it's actually quite valuable, especially in places where that word has been demonized. It can actually be highly valuable to identify as an anarchist, yeah, because it serves to disrupt people's stereotypical ideas of what anarchists are and what anarchism is in a broader sense. And I think, you know, me, I as you can see, I sort of present in this more academic, articulate fashion, right? I'm not dressing in all black with circle A patches all over me and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that often serves to sort of disrupt people's stereotypical understandings. And so I do tend to go around identifying as an anarchist in a casual sense, obviously not in a business environment. I think that's pretty well just asking to be fired around here. And I've actually found that, you know, this kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier. This might serve as a useful segue. There are the seeds of an ideological anarchism within both the urban and the rural areas. And I'll at least just speak for Oklahoma. I think it's true in a lot of places, though, but they're different. The aspects of anarchism that are present are different. So in the urban areas, what I found, people lean a little more liberal, but what they really don't like is work. They know that they don't like the structure of the job they've got. They know they're miserable and overworked and underpaid. They know that they're suffering economically and so on. In the urban in Tulsa especially, you know, in the urban areas, that's one of the big sort of vectors for communication. In the rural areas, I think it's more like what you were discussing earlier, that there's this sort of localist conception that has caught on among people who consider themselves Republicans. And we could talk a lot about the history of where this came about. This is like kind of relatively modern. It's probably only true since like about the 50s or 60s, but it's true in the modern era. They think of themselves as being about small government and doing things down on the ground and, you know, integrating with the people that are there in your community, and local government should be where all of the power is, and so on. And that is often a very good vector for talking about anarchism with these people as well. In both occasions, you have to connect a lot of dots because their solutions in both the urban centers and in rural areas are often really, really bad solutions that are quite not only destructive, but self-destructive. But yes, no, those potentials are there. I personally take a much more sort of forward out approach where I say precisely what I believe. I try not to sugarcoat it, but I do try to simplify it.
Mm-hmm. But we've in prefiguration that word the and which is the idea of building now. What we're going the structure to begin the foundation and in those relationships now, you know, in doing that. And you have a lot broken out a couple of ways in which you think this would be a good way to like bridge these gaps and to be able to talk about the problems that, you know, like an integral can we create a space, the conditions in which we can talk about what the problems are and what the solutions are, because right now we don't even have a space in which we could even agree or even talk about what even the conditions are, what even this is, what's even happening with the streams or the food shelter, the food web or the shelter, food shelter, the fiber shed, or what we can't even, there's no barely even language for it, because we're what we need, or even be able to talk about what we believe as a collective, no matter what that collective is, should happen in the future. We don't even have a way of, because some people are really interested in making sure that we have an all Catholic nation, you know, here, just to, that would solve it. You know, that would solve everything. You know, women would just cover their arms and, you know, we could get all on board with the same religion, you know? So there's real, we can both talk, we both are talking about this in the same way, but, you know, like you said, the solutions end up, you know, again, it favoring one again, building hierarchy again. So can you unpack a little bit about the four pillars and the way of building or talking about how fundamentally the way we look at problems and talking about problems and is builds the whole structure, not necessarily the bottom down structure. I may have been giving it too much away.
Okay. So first I'll say, because, you know, we've used this word prefiguration numerous times and we didn't really clearly define it. I think you did there closely for the first time. But this idea of prefiguration and anarchism is basically the concept that we have to configure as much of a future ideal society within the current society as conceivably possible. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this has been stated as, and this was an old saying of the IWW in the early 1900s, and that was that we are building the new in the shell of the old, right? And I think this is a very central principle for anarchists. It kind of, if you think about it, leads back to that means ends unity thing, right? And what the anarchist is really trying to point out is that you're not going to achieve a horizontal society as a society that has freed itself from coercion and domination and all of that by creating another society, another hierarchical power structure. Hierarchy does not dissolve itself at any point. That's not something that happens. If you build a hierarchical power structure, it is going to perpetuate itself. So there's no way to use a hierarchical power structure to build a horizontal power structure. As soon as you try, if like, let's use reformism as an example, trying to reform this structure. If we take the back of trying to reform this structure, there eventually comes a point where after you reformed it to such a, once you reform it to such a degree that you are actually putting its fundamental relations in threat, all it does is just stop you from doing any more reform, right? That's what it does. It sort of becomes, it develops this incredible inertia against further change. And it often has a really terrible knee-jerk backlash effect where, in fact, historically, it escalates into fascism in response. That's often what takes place. In the best case scenario, we see something like Sweden or Switzerland, which had extensive social democratic reform programs, but which we can now see eventually reached a high watermark and have begun to backslide once again. So the anarchist offers an alternative. They say, we're not going to beg for scraps from the table of those who already have power. We are not going to ask for permission from power structures to act. We are going to act now to construct new power structures. And we're going to do everything that we can to make those new power structures. We want those to accumulate power. We want the horizontal power structures to accumulate power. And we want those to grow more and more active, larger and larger, including more and more people. And as that takes place, we are essentially building the new in the shell of the old. The last thing, because, you know, I saw that Jason unmuted himself for just a second. But the last thing is, you mentioned the four pillars, and I assume you're talking about the ones from Constructing the Revolution. But the idea is that we need to build councils. So we need to build those democratic means to make decisions together, as was discussed, has been kind of discussed here in this particular program. We need to build economics, which is to say we need to build things like cooperatives or free stores, a means of direct distribution where we just take excesses that people have and we distribute them to people that are in need. That also might involve, for example, creating unions within capitalist workplaces. Then we actually need defense. Defense is necessary both so that we can keep ourselves safe from people that are currently enemies in society. Like I think we have lots of example of those trans events. We can see why now we're starting to need defense. But it could also escalate, because at a later date, it is very unlikely that a hierarchical power structure is going to let us build this. And we need to be able to defend ourselves in that occasion. And the last thing is intelligence, which is to say, we need to know what enemies are doing. We need to be able to gather intel. We need to be able to, take, for example, a more kind of mundane example, gathering information on known fascists who are doing damage, who are, violently coercing people in society. This might be an example of intelligence. So these four pillars, I think, are what we have to build in order to succeed, because a horizontal power structure is going to need all of those things. And what we have to do in building all of those is build them as consistently in accordance with our future principles as we conceivably can. So ramble over. I hand the mic to you, Jason.
Tell me, yeah. Jason, if that doesn't sound like a homestead, doesn't sound like a group of homesteaders in a rural area that's actually is actually the structure that already exists in rural areas in which families or groups of families that have known each other for generations and generations already operate.
Yeah, well, one idea I had a few days ago is that I think an idea that most people can get on board with is expanding the commons, right? Because even people who are like, you mentioned socialism and they have very negative connotations with that word. But you mentioned the commons and you describe what that is, and they're like, oh, that means I let my neighbor hunt on my land. Oh yeah, we do that all the time, right? Or it means, mutual aid networks. Oh yeah, like we do that all the time. And so I think part of kind of building a movement or getting more people on board is, relating on these very kind of tangible, ways of just how people have historically helped each other survive, right? And we're in a point of society now. I wanted to speak on also kind of the theory of change. And there was a few tweets a while back that you had, Daniel, which I really liked, about along the lines of like, nobody is going to build, you know, these alternative structures for you. And it kind of aligns with kind of how I think about theory of change, that, you know, I'm really influenced by kind of the panarchy adaptive cycle model. And I do think we're kind of heading towards what's called the back loop, which is basically like our current industrial capitalist civilization is just, it cannot last. But just to assume that it can collapse and then you build, as you said in your tweet, is that, well, power structures, you know, will find a way to keep you down even in a post-collapse society. And so you need to build, you know, these alternative patterns of organization that you know can defend themselves and everything else. Start building them now, start laying the groundwork. And you know, at least according to the adaptive cycle model, once release or collapse or starts happening, there's a lot of collateral damage. It sucks. It's not something necessarily to look forward to, but one thing that's good about it is it releases a lot of energy. It releases actually a lot of activation energy that if you already have the blueprints in place, then, you know, they can rapidly build. And so that's that to me, when you say build the new in the shell of the old, that's really kind of, you know, part of, you know, like that describes that very well. You know, another way people have described it is like kind of building this kind of alternative dual power, kind of parasitizing the old system. You know, that doesn't necessarily need to sound as bad as it sounds, but
or cannibalizing, consuming, I don't know. Yeah, something like that.
Right. So I like mushrooms. Still, you're utilizing, you know, so another person used the word, you're composting the old civilization to build the new, right? If you want to get more, you know, agroecological about it. So yeah, I guess, I don't know if that's a question. Okay, yeah, I guess this idea of expanding the commons, and we can, you know, we need to wrap up pretty soon, but yeah, what are some, let's talk about, especially, I guess, in the context of food production, because that's something that is kind of one of my areas of focus, is I see, you know, especially probably a lower energy throughput society in the future, just biophysically necessary, that a lot more people are going to have to be involved with food production, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be a lot of questions about skills as well as access, right? Mm-hmm. Access to land, because the ownership structure, most people can't afford to go buy a farm, right? And so how can we, you know, what are some practical ways to both build the skills, just, you know, mm-hmm. technical skills, you know, whether they're agroecological or permacultural, you know, whatever kind of system you subscribe to, you know, and start with whatever we have, right? It's like, you might not be able to get access to land, but how can we as a community, you know, start, you know, expanding our access to land, you know, as, or an individual, you might have the funds to go buy a homestead or farmstead, and that's great. And that's what a lot of doomer optimists do. But, you know, in a municipal, especially in a municipal context, in an urban context, you know, we hear about, you know, urban gardens, we hear about community land trusts, these various things. Do you want to talk about kind of what you've seen and how people have approached kind of both this kind of skill building element as well as
perfect.
Just expanding access, expanding the commons.
Perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very much a topic that I've thought about a lot, and the group that I'm with, Cooperation Tulsa, definitely thinks about this topic quite a bit as well. I think that the answer to the question is probably going to be very contextual to whether you are in an urban setting, a suburban setting, or a rural setting, right? I think that in those three contexts, you're going to be able to do different kinds of approaches. But I actually think that in a general sense, you're sort of like least constrained in the rural context, which is to say you can kind of just like go do it with way lower barrier to entry. There's just a lot more open space. There's just a lot let the and the more of that ecological space is just sort of like unmonitored. And as you said, it's kind of like just way easier to convince your friend Bill down the street to let you build a garden on his land. You know, like there's just people just do have access to quite a bit more land. Of course, that's changing, you know, more and more of the rural landscape is being bought by big corporations and so on. But it still is the case as we speak. in a suburban area, I think it probably is going to be it's going to boil down to like helping people build those gardens in their backyard, or distributing some form of technology that allows them to grow things that they need within their household. So, you know, we've seen a lot of these things where there's like, you know, mushroom birthing chambers and people growing their own herbs and spices and stuff in those, you know, like there are these little technological chambers and stuff. That kind of stuff might be an interesting avenue to explore. And lastly, you mentioned, you know, now we're in the urban setting, and the urban setting is by far the most challenging. And it's by far the most challenging because there's just almost no available land, right? Like, and so much of the land is like wrecked. Like it is just like the soil is wrecked. And moreover, even it's not even just that it has very little nutrition, but it is often like actually polluted by really terrible, you know, like lead and all kinds of like stuff from runoff, and you have to like remediate that soil. So like, for example, Cooperation Tulsa, we built small community gardens at two historically Black churches here in Tulsa, because that a lot of that was in correspondence like the George Floyd uprisings. And those we built as above ground garden beds, even though in both occasions they had soil. In one of the occasions there was lead, and in the other occasion the soil was just awful. It was just, you know, almost useless. So we did above ground garden beds in both those situations. And how did we get the money? On the first one, a GoFundMe. Okay, we just did a GoFundMe. We told people what we were planning on doing. They gave us a ton of money. We dumped it into the Vernon AME Church Garden. In the second one, we actually applied for a grant. So if your organization is, say, like a 501c3 or something, that's a great way to go. Honestly, you'd be shocked to know the number of grants out there that would be thousands of dollars to just build a community garden, okay? And the last one is we were given a chunk of land, which we've called Flat Rock, which we now plan to, expand into a much more substantial agricultural project. It may end up being lots of above ground garden beds as well, or we might actually try to remediate the soil, because we actually have like 2.5 acres of land that is ours. So I think you're also right to point to a community land trust model. I think that insofar as anybody is interested in a community land trust model, I would highly recommend they look into another cooperation project, and that is Cooperation Jackson. Mm-hmm. So Cooperation Jackson is extremely inspiring. There's a huge amount of for us to learn from it. They have done an extensive community land trust project there in Jackson, Mississippi. And in fact, Cooperation Jackson is one of the reasons why we have all these groups called Cooperation X. Okay, like that, they were the first one. They really pioneered a lot of this, and their organization is much more Black in general, and is associated with sort of like a historical Pan-Africanism and stuff. But it's also based around this communalist concept of like reclaiming the commons. And one thing I'd really like to emphasize that I think was absolutely on the nose is that this language of creating and reclaiming the commons is a very good sort of language to use, because I think it immediately communicates something more holistic about what it is we're actually trying to do to people. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Yeah.
That's the outpicturing. That's you can like, people will see that. You can see that goes healthy atmosphere, healthy, you know, cheaper food. It's like the collection of like, I grow rabbits and, you know, I like rabbits. So I want to grow rabbits. And it was like, so I'll trade you, you know, I've got rabbits and skins and fertilizer that's, you know, so let's, you know, you're growing watermelons and squash that I don't have, you know, I don't have the thing for. You grow the hay, I'll give you a rabbit every 6 months. You know, I mean, this,
yeah, I mean, these are ancient, you know, ancient forms of human organization, that it's almost like we have to, you know, rediscover many ancient forms of human organization in this kind of modern context that's technologically enabled. But we have all of this baggage of the last, you know, few hundred years. But we also have the affordances, you know, of the, you know, the technology enabled, especially around coordination. I guess I'll just my last piece I'll just say is, you know, that's what Doomer Optimism is about, is like first recognizing that, hey, like our current industrial global capitalist civilization is doomed, but you know, that actually is kind of exciting. It can be exciting if you bring in this hope that, that you're talking about and realize that there's so much that we can actually do. So yeah, this all sounds great to me. It, you guys have any last words?
My last word will be say thank you both. To say thanks to both of you again. This project, just in the way that Daniel talks about this, just is a pretty good description of what a healthy human flowering kind of looks like. And I would think that no matter what your political philosophy is, you would want your neighbor to be all that they could be, you know, you know, to borrow a phrase from the army, you know, you would, I hope that I could want you to live like you want to live. You know, I could want you to have what you wanted. I could, low-cost, somostasu, kino, bavant, I could want you to genuinely be happy because you wouldn't be bothering me, right? Because if we could give everybody the conditions for their own happiness, I don't have to make you happy. That's your own project, I'm afraid. But I can create the conditions the very best I can, at least not make sure that your unhappiness is my happiness require. You know, my happiness requires your suffering. So, and I think that I think that's the project. And I think Doomer Optimism has been an exciting place to pursue these ideas. Thanks for helping me do that.
Yeah, I think the last thing I would say is a kind of perfectly segued from that. And that is, you know, as I said earlier, this principle of solidarity is extremely important to anarchists. I think that a lot of people, their misunderstanding is that anarchism is purely individualistic. It's about, you know, doing for yourself and screw everyone else and so on. But that's not the case. And anarchism is predicated to a significant degree on this cooperative impulse, on the impulse of what we call mutual aid. And I want to emphasize that, you know, a lot of the stuff we've discussed this evening has to do with, you know, self-sufficiency and localism. But I think that the last thing that the anarchist would want to emphasize is that these things become truly transformative. They add up into something more than the sum of their parts when we cooperate, when we combine together into these, you know, confederations or federations of people that can, act together with concerted effort to produce something that benefits everyone, that we diminish a society of competition and we try to create a society of cooperation, precisely as you said, because a society of competition requires that you fail for me to succeed. We need to create a society that is so much less zero sum, that is so much more based around this communal aspect and trying to find the harmony of all of our needs.
Beautiful. Well, this was great. I'm just sad that we have to wrap up so soon. Hopefully, I would love to continue the discussion sometime, and hopefully we can have you back. I think this is great, Daniel. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Good to be on.
Take care, everyone.